What I would like to do today is to look at marketization of higher education, and not to take it as something which is evident, because you can, I will start with that. You have many papers, books, and so on, telling about the marketization of higher education. And one thing I would like to question today is, how far is this true? And how far are markets present and observable in higher education and research? And if there are markets, how do they work? So I think that these are questions which are not so many time asked. So if you look at marketization, and if you take the way Marie-Laure Tchelik is defining marketization, she wrote in 2006 that marketization refers both to market ideologies and market-oriented reforms. And this is most of the time the way marketization of higher education can be understood and has been described. And if I take first the market ideologies, I think that you can find many evidence that the definitions of higher education and research activities has changed, and that the idea of knowledge as capital has spread. While the traditional sociology of science around Merton considered teaching and research as public goods, they become more and more considered as private goods, and building on human capital theories, many authors outlined the individual benefits gained by individuals trained in higher education. So individual benefits in terms of revenues, of course, but also social benefits such as health, culture, longevity, and etc. And this argument of teaching being a private good played an important role in the introduction and increase of tuition fees in the UK, for instance. One of its major tenants, Nicholas Barr, an economist, often used this argument to justify that those who will beneficiate their own life from their studies should pay fees, all the more as these students already originate from well-off classes. So there was also something about fiscal equality and justice. Another shift concerns research results and discoveries and their transformation into patents and licenses, not only to protect discoveries, but also for universities to get revenues from them. Whether it is true or not that you can get revenues from patents for as a university could be discussed, and we all, many authors show that only some universities are really getting more revenues from that, but everybody is doing these kind of things. And we also know from historians that it's not something that it's so new, but it's really developed a lot over time. And for instance, Elizabeth Pope Berman, in her book Creating the Market University, shows how it developed in the case of biotechnology in the US. So these are some indication of what some authors call the rise of academic capitalism. Sheila Slaughter and Gary Rhodes, for instance, used that expression in 2004, or the McDonaldization of universities, which is also a term I'm taking care of, which is often used in the case of universities. Second, if now I look at market-oriented reforms, here again you have many evidence of these trends in higher education, and one aspect of it is the introduction of methods and instruments borrowed from firms and the shift from collegial to managerial forms of governance, and the end, in a way, of the Republic of Science as described by Michael Polanyi, the brother of Carl Polanyi. But market-oriented reforms also push for the transformation of the national higher education system into highly differentiated system. And this process, first of all, concerns continental Europe, where university systems developed according to a predominantly egalitarian rhetoric. And France is probably the most representative country of this egalitarian model, where each university in the past was supposed to be equal to the other, or at least equivalent to the others, and with a system of granting degrees that were equivalent from one place to another all over France, and also a way of allocating public funding that was based on a formula which was exactly the same for all universities. And this has dramatically changed in the last years. In France, of course, with the Grand Emprunt, for instance, which is the equivalent of the German initiative, the Excellence Initiative in Germany. So we have many evidence that we have these market-oriented reforms. We have many evidence that we have these market ideologies spreading all over higher education. But does it mean that we have more markets? And where do we have very precisely markets in higher education? That's what I would like to discuss now. So I will do that in 3 points. First, I will look at markets and differentiate markets from competition and exchange, coming back to the definition of market by Weber. And then I would like to nevertheless look at some specific markets in higher education, and there are 2 of them I will speak about today. The first one is the market for professors, and the second one is the, if I have time, is the market for students. And what I would like to focus on is one specific aspect on markets, which is pricing. So how do we set the price of professors when we have a market for professors? And I will say that it's not everywhere that we have a market for professors. And how do we set fees on the market of students, for students, when you have a market for students, which is also not always the case in all countries. So first point about definitions of markets, competition, and exchange. What I would like to do is to take a definition of market based on Weber. And what I did is not to take Weber. I just take the sentence from Zweigbergk in 1998, which really summing up the definition of markets by Weber. So I read it quickly. The heart of Weber's analysis of the market consists of the idea that its core is made up of one type of economic action, exchange, which is simultaneously oriented in 2 directions, towards one's exchange partner, so its struggle over the price, and towards one's competitor, struggle between competitors. So I think there are 2 conditions that are defining what a market is. At least this is the definition I will take today. The first one is that you need to have this economic action, so you need to have some exchange about the price and struggle for price. And the second one is that buyers are competing one against another, while suppliers are also competing one against another. And I will try to look at different processes and to see whether they fit with this definition or not. So something which is very frequent in the recent development of higher education is the development of project-based funding on the one hand, and the development of contracts between the government and universities on the other. And here again, there is no doubt that project-based funding has considerably increased over the last years. And university budgets increasingly rely on such processes for research, but not only for research. The German Excellence Initiative shows that it was also for institutions and for graduate schools, for instance. But can we speak of a market for grants? Here I would say no. I don't think we can speak of a market for grants. The reason for that is that project-based funding increases competition for resources, but I don't think we can really speak of exchange in this case. That's an argument I would like to develop. If I start with competition in the case of research, project-based funding for research. If I start for that, it's clear that it increases competition between institutions, between research units, and between individuals. What would be called the buyers, in a way, on the market. But one can also show that there is also increased competition between the providers, between the DFG, for instance, and the ERC at the European level, or the European Framework Programme for Research and Development. And in France, for instance, where the Ministry observed a decrease in the participation of the French to the framework program, to the European framework program. They explain this by the success of the ANR, the French DFG, and by the attention paid by French academics to the French Excellence Initiative, the Grand Emprunt. So we can see that there is a kind of competition among the people providing project-based funding in a way, so that nevertheless, so that the researchers or the institutions can choose in a way for one provider rather than for another. But nevertheless, I would argue that in this case, there is no really exchange about the research-based project. So there is competition, but no exchange, because there is no negotiations of the grants. You receive the grants, the grants may be cut if you compare what you were asking for and what you receive, but there is no negotiation about these cuts. And you also do not see any struggle for the projects. You never see, for instance, DFG getting to someone who has an ERC and telling this person, I will give you more than what the ERC is giving. So I think that in this case, it's difficult to speak of a market for grants, but maybe you don't agree with that. That's a point I would like to discuss with you. So in this case, I think there is increased competition, but not really exchange, and not a real market, if it does exist, but a market in the definition of Weber. The second example I would like to take is a case where you have exchange, but not really competition. And here I will take the case of the new allocation mechanisms, which were introduced in many countries and which are defined as contractual funding. So such mechanisms, for instance, have been introduced in France in the beginning of the 90s. Four-year contracts, now it's five-year contracts, but at that time that was four-year contracts, are signed between the French ministry and each university. And these contracts represent a part of the budget allocated to universities. So there is one part which is based on inputs, so it's again a formula, the number of students, for instance, or the number of square meters. Another part of the budget is allocated on performance. That's something which is new in French, which was introduced 3 years ago. And one part is based on this contractual basis. So there is a negotiation between each university and the ministry on a specific project that the university wants to develop. And here I would say there is really exchange, because there is really a negotiation about the level of a reserve of a budget that will be given to the university. So the ministry and the university are bargaining about how much the university will get in terms of budget at that time. But at the same time, I think there is no real competition in this case. So there is exchange, but no competition among suppliers, because there is only one supplier, which is the public authority. So there is no competition at that point. And there is also no competition among what would be the buyers, the universities, because they have all access to the supplier. They are, in a way, obliged to sign this contract. They are not... And they first have to convince the ministry that they should get more according to the project, but not that they should get more than the others. There was not this kind of discussion at that point. So they are not really competing one against another, the universities, when you have this contractual funding. So more competitions in some cases, but no exchange. And in all cases, you have exchange, but no competition. So I would say that many of the mechanisms which are introduced into higher education and which are most of the time called quasi-markets are very vague in a way, and that we should look more carefully at what kind of mechanisms which are behind these kinds of new allocation of funding. So this being said, I think that nevertheless, in some cases, not in the one I discussed previously, but in some cases, we can nevertheless speak of markets. And I think there are two cases, at least, I take this one as example. I don't say that they are the only one, but at least in two cases, we can speak of a market in higher education. The first one is the market for professors. From my point of view, this is the case when not only universities compete one against another for the best candidates, and when candidates compete one against another to be recruited, which is the competition situation, but also when all academics occupying the same kind of position are not proposed the same prize. So to be concrete about cases where you have a market for professors, that would be the case for me in Germany, where you have this negotiation when you are appointed as a professor, especially when you are Vedrai. No, is it right?
Yeah.
No more Sophia, Vedrai. And it's also the case, of course, in the US, where you have this negotiation when you are recruited in a university, and I will come back to this after that. And I think that in this case, in this country, there is a form of market for professors because you have competition and exchange at the same time. It's not the case in France, for instance, where you have competition for positions, but there is no negotiation at all when you get this position. There is no negotiation about the salaries because it's a scale, a national scale, and your price, your salary, is fixed according to your age and your seniority in the in higher education. So it's a very different process. I speak of price and not of salary because most of the time, not only salaries are discussed at that moment. There are also discussions about working conditions. How many? What widget will you get for computer? Will you get assistance? Will you get a budget for books and so on? But also, and especially in the case of the US, you also have a negotiation about personal benefits. So health insurance, support to help the spouse find a job, special loans to buy a house. So all kind of things which are discussed at that moment. So it's not only a question of salary, it's really a question of price. There are different components in this price. The second example, from my point of view, of a market in higher education is market for students. But again, it doesn't exist everywhere. There are specific conditions where a market for students can exist. And for me, it exists not only when institutions compete for the best students and students compete to get access to the best institutions, but also when fees vary from one institution to another, or may even vary from one student to another within the same institutions, as it very often happens in the US. I will come back to that too if I have time. So the first part of my talk was to try to sort out when we can speak of a market in the case of higher education. So not only where we find marketization, I think we have marketization of higher education, but it doesn't mean that we have markets everywhere or that the mechanisms of markets are present everywhere. And I try to identify some places or some cases where markets are observable. So if we have a market, the next question to ask is, how does it work? What kind of market do we have in higher education? And as I said at the beginning, I will try to focus on one specific aspect, which is pricing. So I'm coming to my second point, which is about the price of academics. And then I will come to the fees and how they are set. So to present the price, some results about the price of academics, I will build on a study I led at the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000, on France, Germany, and the United States, and on the book I published in French in 2005, and which was published in English by Routledge in 2009. So I will take some of the results I had in this study, which was about the academic labor market in the three countries, with a specific focus on hiring. How do you hire colleagues and what happens when you hire people in the different countries. So I worked on three countries, France, Germany, and the US. Most of the work was done in France and in Germany because that was at the beginning the comparison I wanted to do. And so in France, we studied five hiring committees in history. At that time, hiring committees in France were set for 5 years. So you could really work on a kind of hiring committee, how do they work together and so on. And I worked only on two disciplines, history and math. So five hiring committees in history, five hiring committees in math in France. But of course, I won't speak of France because, as I said, there is no market there for professors, really. In Germany, we work on four history departments and four mathematics departments. And because I spent a year in the US, it was possible to have a kind of spot study in the US. And I decided to work only on private research universities, non-for-profit, but private research universities. Quite good universities, but not on the top 10. And there, I studied two history departments and two mathematics departments. And so they are located in three different private universities. So I worked with interviews. I would have loved to do observation, but it was not possible. First of all, in France, because if I was sitting in the room where it was occurring, the candidates could have sued and say it doesn't work. And in the case of Germany and the US, I think it would be less difficult in terms of legal presence during a hiring committee, but it was much more difficult to find to be at the right moment at the right place. So, you know, because of course in France, all the recruitments are most of the time occurring right now. So it's very concentrated, which is not the case in the other countries where. So it's much more difficult, of course, to do this kind of thing. So it's mostly based on interviews led with people sitting in committees, but also with deans and heads of department, of course. Yeah. So what I should say about that first is that the market for professors can be studied as an economics of quality. So Karl Pick first used the notion of economics of quality and he shifted to the notion of economics of singularities. But at the beginning, the first paper he wrote about that was 1989. And it was the economics of quality. And I just very quickly, because I suppose you know this since it has been translated now in English in 2010, this book. But I very quickly sum up what I found interesting in this very thick study of Karl Pick. So as you know, he developed this idea of economics of quality when he was trying to understand how does lawyers find clients. And the idea of Karl Pick was that in France, lawyers are not allowed to advertise. So they cannot say that they are very good. They cannot say that they had success at that or that. They can even not say that they were trained at that place rather than at another place. So they just put their name on the wall. So if you are a client, how do you choose a lawyer? That was the question. And so the question of Karl Pick, as you know, is there is a high uncertainty on the quality of the lawyer. So how can the client find a lawyer? So how is it possible for this market to function? So how is it possible for supply to meet demand if you have this high uncertainty on the quality of lawyer? So the answer of Karl Pick, you know it, is that the people, when they look for a lawyer, when they need a lawyer, they ask their friends or they ask their family. So they use their network in order to find a lawyer. And so that's the way it works. And when you have a lawyer, then you have a discussion with the lawyer about the honoraria you will pay for the lawyer. So what is for me interesting in this process is that, in fact, first of all, quality and not price is the operator when supply meets demand. So during the search process, when you're looking for a lawyer, you're not looking for price. You're just looking for someone, and you use your network to find this person. And the second thing which is interesting in this process from my point of view is that the price is set after supply and demand have met. So there are in fact two processes, a process during which you assess the quality of what you would like to buy, and a process which is coming after that, where you decide how much you want to pay, you will accept to pay to buy this product, good or person you have found. And if you look at the way academics are recruited, you have exactly the same processes. So first of all, hiring committee are sitting and they are trying to find out the best candidate, whatever the best means. It may depend a lot from one department to another, from one institution to another. That's another issue. But first they sit, and there you have peers sitting together and trying to find out who is the best. And then you have another process, not with the same people most of the time. So the people sitting in the hiring committees most of the time do not participate to the next process. And then you have to decide how much you will be giving to this person to come and to recruit this person. So it's exactly what Karpik is describing for lawyers in terms of the two processes which have to be distinguished if you want to understand how it works. So at that time, what I did, I will not present all that because that would be too long and too... it's not really focused on what I wanted to do at the beginning, but when I started this study about hiring committees and recruitment in the three countries, I had three questions. The first one was, how do recruiters come to an agreement on quality? So how do you decide who the best candidate is? I will not speak of that today. And then I had two other questions. If you know how you find the best candidate, how you do you then set the price? So I have to study the process which is going on after you found the best candidate. And the next question I had is, what is the relationship between the judgment which has been made by the hiring committee and the price proposed to the candidate? So is there any relationship between the quality as assessed by the committee and the price which is proposed to the candidate? So, what did I see when I did that? What I saw is that first, in the different countries, and especially comparing Germany and the US, you have very different pricing processes from one country to another. And in the case of the US, you even have very different pricing processes. If you look at assistant professors, the first position, and if you're looking at more senior persons. So I won't present all these processes. I will only focus on one at the end, and I will explain why I focus on this one. And the second thing I observe is that the relationship between the quality of the candidate as assessed by the hiring committee and the price, this relationship is very loose. So that there is no strong connection between the quality of the candidate and the price which is offered to the candidate. And to argue or to try to convince you of that, I will take the case of the U.S. assistant professors, which is probably the more characteristics for that. So in the U.S., as in Germany, as in France, you have a hiring committee and they rank candidates. And once you have this ranking, you start a negotiation with the first person on the ranking. In the four departments I studied in the U.S., this negotiation did not happen between the candidate, him or herself, and the dean. It was a negotiation between the head of department and the dean. And what I observe is that the department chair has many reasons to try to get as much as possible for the candidate, whatever the quality of the candidate. He or she wants to have as much as possible. And there are many reasons for that. The first reason is that he or she wants to attract the candidate. So if you don't propose enough, the candidate will go away if he or she has another position, but it could go away. Or if you propose not enough, if you don't propose enough to the candidate, he may leave after a few years. And department chairs do not like that, because they have to repeat the recruitment process and so on, and they don't want the candidate to leave after 2 or 3 years because the candidate doesn't have enough when he was recruited. And the third reason for the department head to really try to get as much as possible is that if he gets more for this candidate, he or she will be able to negotiate with the dean for the whole department afterwards. So I'd say, look, we recruited this person recently, we gave this person this salary, and the others, they have lower salaries, or the salaries are not high enough in comparison with the others. So it's a good basis for the department chair to discuss. So the department chair has many reasons to get as much as possible. And of course, the dean is in another situation. He wants to get the candidate for the best price that is high enough for the candidate to come, but not more than what the candidate would accept to come. So there is a discussion, and this discussion leads very often to a kind of inflation, in fact, because the head of department has much more information about what the candidates want to do than the dean, and so the dean very often is kind of obliged to follow the head, the department chair. So that's one first thing I observe in this. Then if I come back to the level of the price, so what do you propose a candidate when you have someone ranked first after a hiring committee? How do you know, as a department chair, how much you should propose this person? And I will take for that only the case of salaries, because it's the more it's the very clear to look at how it works. When I ask them, how do you know how much you should propose a candidate? They tell me, I look at what the departments I consider equal to us and what they propose a candidate. So, yeah, can you tell me how it works? And, you know, when we go to conference or when we go to the US Association, American Association for History, or we discuss with other department chairs and we discuss about the prices and the salaries we propose to candidates. And you have to think, you have not to forget that we are in private institutions, so there is no information about the salaries. For the public institutions in the US, they publish the salaries they give, but not for the private. And in the private universities, people do not know how much the colleagues are getting. But the department chairs, they discuss one with another, and so they know what the others are proposing. And they say, we propose the same as the departments we consider equal to our department in terms of reputation, etc., and excellence. And so I ask them, can you give me an example of the department you consider as equal to you? And most of the time, in history that was, all the time, they said, Princeton. And as I said at the beginning, there are very good departments, but they're not at the top 10. But of course, so they propose the same as the department they consider equal to them or equivalent to them. So in fact, what is proposed to the candidate is not the price of the candidate. It's much more the price of the department or the price of the market, if you want. No? So, which is the basis for the negotiation. I have to add something about that. So if I come back to the question I had before, what is the relationship between the quality of the candidate and the price which is proposed to the candidate? We can see that it's not very tightly coupled. So they don't look at how high or how good the hiring committee thinks the candidate is. They much more try to look at how they locate themselves on the market for professors. And it's very close to what Harrison White described about the way markets are working. It's exactly the same kind of mechanism you can see here. So, if I come to my third point now, which is about fees or the price of higher education. Here, I cannot rely on my own study about that because I haven't done that for the moment. It's much more the prospective part of the paper. I think there is really something to do about fees and to look at in terms of fees when you have a market for students. The first thing I would like to say and to mention is that this market for students is really expanding. First of all, you have more countries asking for fees, and when I mean fees, I mean high fees, of course, not what we ask in France, which is 300 euros per year. It's called fees, but it's not the kind of situation I'm speaking of here. And you have also more institutions asking for fees. And for instance, my own institution, Sciences Po, they decided some years ago really to increase very clearly the fees they are asking for students. Of course, they develop also financial aid and so on, but it's really very high compared to what you pay to French universities. And I 2 days ago, I received information about higher education in France, and I read that Sciences Po Toulouse, which is one of these Institut d'études politiques in the province, they also decided to raise their fees. And so there is a kind of mechanism so that they are looking at what each other and trying and doing the same. So it's kind of process you can see in many countries. In countries where fees already existed, you really have an increase in the level of fees. And if I start with the UK, in fact, you can see that in the UK, this idea of fees, of high fees, started in the 80s for international students. At the beginning, they decided to ask international students to pay quite high fees. But then, in the 90s, there were a lot of discussions, and they came to a point in 1997 where they decided that for undergraduates, I'm just speaking of undergraduates here, you can ask up to £1,000. In 2004, it went up to £3,000, and now they can go up to £9,000. And what is interesting in the case of the UK is that for the two first rise, what was observed is that all institutions went up to the higher price, so that there was a kind of distribution of institutions, and you could see that it was flat. They were all at £1,000, and then when it again went up in 2004, they almost all went up to £3,000. So you had this kind of distributions that you can see. I don't have it for the last step, but I try just to have a look on the website of some UK university. Yeah, surprisingly, the LSE is 8,500 pound a year for undergraduate. Cambridge 9,000, UCL 9,000, Kingston University. Probably you don't know it. Do you know it?
No,
it's a former polytechnic, and it's probably one of the, not the lowest, but not a very well-known university, £8,750 pounds a year for undergraduate. Durham University, 9,000. University of Nottingham. So I took very different universities, and what you see is that they are all very close to the 9,000 pounds. So if I now come to the US, come back to the US, Here, I just take some figures from report looking at all the US, because of course I could have looked also at some institutions, and there are not so many reports really comparing what is going on average everywhere in the US. So there is an old report of 1999, and there are some figures in the from the College Board in 2000, looking at the period 2004-2008. But in this report of 1999, you can see that fees multiplied by 5 between 1976 and 1996, and it means multiplied by 2 after adjusting for inflation. And the share of fees in the budget of public universities raised from 13% to 18%, and from 37% to 43% in private universities. According to the College Board, between 2004 and 2008, there was a mean increase in college tuition of 4.2% annually. So really, you can see that it's something which is really increasing all the time. So now if I try to understand how this price is set, there are many explanations I found in the literature, and I just want to list them here because for the moment I don't really know which one to choose as an explanation because, as I said, I haven't been working on, I have no empirical study on that. That's something I would like to do. There are first some explanations about telling that it will increase until the family will refuse to pay for it. So there is a kind of what they call a political price, which is what buyers can afford and can accept. And in some, for some authors, we are already close to what is acceptable, at least in the US, but also says that it can still raise and that it should go on. And then another question which is quite often raised in this kind of publications is how far can the student loan debt grow? And as you probably know, it's a big issue right now in the US, where there are really problems for students to pay back the loan they have contracted to for their study. And I don't know whether it will work, but I found Wells Fargo, does it work or not? No, it doesn't matter.
It's coming.
It's there. So I found on the web many institutions like that, like Wells Fargo. Do you know about Wells Fargo?
Yeah.
And they are proposing loan for the students. And so this one is not very aggressive. I couldn't find one. I just found by chance once, and where it was really, you know, buy now, you know, this kind of thing, buy your loan and for your study. And so that's what you can find. So how far can this go? That's one question. The second explanation for the rise of fees and for understanding how fees are set is the evolution of public funding. Ward and Douglas in the paper of 2006, they very nicely show that you have really a correlation between the decrease of public funding and the increase of fees, so that in fact fees are not really a price, they are a kind of compensation of the decrease of public funding. And that's one explanation which is also given about this. A third explanation you can find about how fees are set is that, in fact, you'll just have anticipation of the price other institutions will choose. And in a way, it's a little bit what you have in the UK, I think, where, in fact, everybody thinks that, I suppose that every institution saw that all institutions will go up to 1,000, and then 3,000, and now 9,000. And so you don't want to be left aside you don't want to be identified as not asking as much as the others, which may reflect you're not as good as the other, so you anticipate what the others will do, and that's one process which might happen. Another process which is close to the previous one, and which is also discussed by Ward and Douglas, is that, and again it's a kind of Iris and White mechanism, is just that you look at what the others are doing. And so if you want to be in one specific category, if you want to be in one group, to be identified to a specific group, you will have about the same prices as the others. And they give this this information. They look at some well-known universities and they put their rankings. I think it was about with based on the U.S. news, and they look at the what they are asking for fees. And what they, of course, observe is that it's not because you're the first that you are the more expensive, but there is a group of universities trying to be on the same, in the same class, and so they have the same kind of fees. Three last explanation, and I'm almost finished. Another explanation of fees and a way to decide how much, how high the fees should be, is could be the expected individual gains for the student. And the explanations here are much more developed for the masters. And the idea is that if after a master you have very good position, the price of the master should be higher than for a master when you don't have a lot of opportunity for job or where job are not very well paid afterwards. Another explanation, and again, that you have all these explanations, but nobody really looked at how it works, so, is the cost of production. So I put production into brackets, but the idea is that how much does it cost to train a student in science, in law, in medicine, and then you should have very different prices according to the real cost of the of training. And last but not least, is what Kratz, von Schreschka, and Deng are looking at with admission policies and enrollment management in a paper they published in 2010, is about the role of marketing strategies of institutions, so that they try to attract specific kind of students in order to find a balance between very good students, but coming from poor background, and maybe not as good students, but with parents who can pay. So the problem is really to find a balance between all that. So that's not the way they use, that's not the main argument of their paper. The main argument of their paper is, first of all, to bring back Selznick into on the scene, and to, let's say, all institutionalism, to defend all institutionalism, and also to show that with this enrollment management, you have value subversion. That's the main point they made. But they nevertheless speak a little bit about prices into it, but not really looking at what impact enrollment management has on prices. So these are the different explanations we have, and one of the things, from my point of view, which will be very interesting, will be to look more closely at enrollment management offices, and to see how they decide for prices. How do you decide that this you will ask for this fee, or for more or for less? And we don't have a lot of study about that. So very quickly, the conclusion, just to repeat what I said during this talk. First of all, there are markets in higher education, but everything is not a market in higher education. And I think that it's good to try to sort out what is market and what is not market. Otherwise, we always speak of market forces without really looking at what is behind. The second result I try to argue is to develop is that pricing results from a variety of processes, and there is not only one process. And so, rather than from the adjustment between supply and demand. I also discussed the fact that the relationship between quality and price is rather loose. But so these are the main arguments I made, but I think that One of the things I would like to say with this talk is that I think there would be a research program to develop much more to look at the pricing mechanism in this specific sphere, because I think there are things that are not exactly what you can find elsewhere, but let's discuss that. And also because I think there has not been very much research has been done in order to look at pricing when it's done, you know, just to take the image of Latour's book *Science in Action*, what I think would be interesting would be to have pricing in action. So looking at how people really develop price, rather than only looking at the results of the process, which are the different figures I gave during the talk. Thank you very much.